Greetings and welcome to the fourth episode of the Record Business Podcast. This is a show where I talk to a variety of names in the music industry, from executives to label owners, songwriters, managers, and more. The podcast builds on my Q&A website where I did exactly the same thing for a number of years. My guest today is yet another American expat based in Sweden for the better part of 40 years. John Cloud is an executive who made a name for himself in the 90s working with MNW and later Playground Music, one of the biggest Swedish indie labels. He now runs his own label and was kind enough to talk to me about his career history and what he's up to now. So I hope you enjoy listening.
Hi there, John. This is going to be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, I hope so.
So I believe you came up in Southern California prior to coming to Sweden in the mid-80s. Does Core FM radio at Redlands ring any bells?
KUR FM 89.1, the beat of the Inland Empire. I still remember the call out. That was my entry into the industry. I mean, I played in bands and always been music interested, but the actual step into the industry was doing radio. And it was at that radio station that I learned about music, a broad spectrum of music, doing shows that, I mean, I didn't know that much about reggae, but I've actually done a reggae show. So, you know, those were the things. You just got thrown into it and you just learned and you did research and you did the shows. And that was kind of my entry into the industry.
So you're the music director.
I became the music director, not because of my vast knowledge of music, but because one night I couldn't lock the door. For some reason, I didn't know why, but it wouldn't lock, and I didn't know what to do. So I said, I can't leave it. So I fell asleep under a table, and I slept there all night. And the radio station manager came in. He goes, oh, the reason it didn't lock is this thing slid down and blocked the lock. And I go, oh, okay, now I know that. But he said, hey, you know, you seem to be trustworthy. Why don't you become the music director? And that's how it started.
Serendipity. KUOR FM seems, at least right now, to be connected to the University of Redlands. Was it back
then? It was, and it's now been sold. They sold it a few years back when they took away the communications program. It lasted, I guess, 2 years after the communication program they took away, which was my program. So I ended up moving on to Cal State University of San Bernardino, where my project became to build the radio station there, KSSB. That was my thesis. I didn't take a lot of courses. My courses were compiled of this building the radio station, setting the budgets, finding the engineer, putting the tower up on the mountain, the whole bit. I did everything from that project. And even, you know, researching what kind of music people wanted to listen to, which became alternative radio, so alternative music. And that was, then I came to Sweden, and then I came back, graduated, and then I left California.
I see. So then you coming to Sweden, I believe, was an exchange program in 84?
Yes, that's right. I got four scholarships. I think it was four. And I came over to Sweden. I did a year of informationsteknik, which is communications. I came over with 24 students, and we had also equally as many Swedes in the same program. So we had a mix, and that was a one-year program. And then I stayed for a few months after, and then at that time I met a woman, and she later became my wife and the mother of my two first Swedish kids. So
as far as actually starting in the Swedish record industry, was it, you're an intern at Radium Records in Gothenburg?
Yes, I was out just meeting labels and meeting people and seeing bands. And there was a band called Sawtor who were signed to Radium. And I contacted the Radium guys and they didn't have any money to hire somebody. And I said, look, just let me work for you for 6 months. Just give me a place to sleep and some food. And I'll get there. I'll travel to Gothenburg because they were based in Gothenburg. I'll travel, you know, on every, I think it was, I would leave on Wednesday evening and I'd be there till Sunday. And then I would come back to Uppsala. So I worked those days. And then I traveled to New York, one trip with the company promoting Sawtor, Union Carbide Productions, and Flesh Quartet, which was Freddie Vaudling's project. And I, you know, was representing him, who was also in a band called Blue for Two, which was on Radium. So it was that whole thing that was kind of my introduction to the Swedish industry. At the same time, I was recording a band, and it was shortly into the Radium period that I signed them to M&W Records, Musiknettet Vaxholm. And I toured with the band, and I was doing promotion. I was trying to sell them internationally. I licensed them in two countries for the label. And it was through that and the coincidence that the singer and the guitarist had a falling out and they broke up. I won't go into details about what that was about, but it was a fun story. And there I was without a band. And 6 months into when I'd finished my 6 month period, I didn't have a music job. And then I sent out some resumes, and M&W called me up and said, "We've talked to the Radium people and they say that you're an up and up guy and we need somebody who speaks English who can sell music." And I came in and I was the international director, and then later became the head of international for M&W.
Very interesting. And you were alongside another individual who was international director, Jean?
Jean Hassel Wernheim. She came in years later. She was helping take care of Asia. So I could relinquish like China and Asian countries to her. And but we still, we communicated. And I, when I met her, we met like three or four people. And she was the one that had the great command of English. And she was great. She did a lot of good work for us at M&W. And then, you know, as you've heard the story, that M&W kind of, you know, there was a lot of people that left the company, and we ended up starting Playground shortly after. And I was one of those founders of Playground. So I was one of 12 that started that company after that.
As far as M&W, it seems like it was revered as one of the more important Swedish labels, especially in the 70s.
Oh, absolutely. That was a great label. And I could say, as far as like having the most fun and being the most creative at that time back then, it was amazing. You know, MTV was playing even Swedish videos. I ended up getting Peter Lamarck, who was in Swedish, added to MTV Europe on this one video called The Finzing and Betre. And it was like top rotation all over Europe with that guy singing in Swedish. It was amazing. There were so many things that were, people were so much more open than they were, that they are now. And it wasn't so niche. Everybody just liked good music. It didn't matter if it was Italian or French or Swedish or English. If it was a great song, it was a great song. And that was a great video too. It was very, very cool. And, you know, there, I had a label called M&W Zone. It was hard rock. I signed Misery Loves Company, who became one of our big sellers. I did a compilation of the best of Union Carbide and what's the other one? Psychotic Youth and a couple others. And Freddie Vaudling. And that's because we bought Radium later. A few years later, when they had economical problems, we ended up buying it. And then I took over A&R there. And then the label laid down, all the artists kind of moved on. And then I started M&W Zone to do heavy stuff. And that's when I signed Misery Loves Company, who, you know, they toured Europe with Paradise Lost and all these big Pitch Shifter and all these big metal bands. And they sold quite well. We licensed them to Earache and some other things. It was a great time. Those areas. And then also the one album that I was very proud of, and Carl Barrier, who was the first album I worked with at M&W, I licensed it all over the world. It was like amazing record, and she's a great artist. And then also Monica Ramos, who was a classical harpist, who this was when Enigma came out and, you know, Enya was just starting. So we wanted to do electronic based album, kind of chill, lounge, that type of thing, but with harp music. And then she would kind of talk sing in Spanish on some songs because she was from Chile. And that record also was one of my proud moments because we licensed it everywhere. People love that record. And I have dozens of issues of that from different countries, pressings and things like that. So that area, that era of music, working and trying different ideas and things, it was amazing. And some of the bands I've worked with have gone on to, or worked with, like either licensing outside or producing or being involved in A&R. All of those are still bands that are working actively. It's great. It was a period of time that, you know, I look back on it and just think, wow, you know, if that would have been a digital era at the same time, it could have been massive.
So like you mentioned, there came a sort of period, late 90s, I guess, where there was some turbulence with M&W.
There was a decision made to go on the stock market and find some stockholders and partner on that. And finding out kind of quickly that they wanted quick results, quick dividends, and no understanding of the creative way of working and the creative thing. And then some other record company people got involved with them and decided to do an aggressive takeover by collecting other stockholders to be majority. And they ended up, in my opinion, ruining a good thing. Needless to say, a bunch of us left. We started Playground, and many of the labels that we had went with us. Everybody just jumped ship. They wanted to work with the people that they trusted and worked with and that were really not about showing dividends, you know. You know, that's why when anybody talks to me about bringing in investors, I get scared, because those guys, I mean, they don't, all they're after is the money, you know. It's a money game, and that's the game they play. I don't criticize them. That's the game they play, but they have no business being in the creative industry, in my opinion.
No, I hear you. So I guess Jonas Sjöström was the CEO. Was he sort of instrumental in you coming along?
Well, Jonas didn't come to Playground till much later. He actually went to Naxos in Hong Kong. So he was the managing director there, taking care of the Naxos releases. He later came in and bought Playground from Edel. And then he bought us others out of the, because we were all stockholders. He bought us out. And, you know, that's how it started. We were separate in starting Playground because we didn't like working for these guys. We didn't think that would be a healthy situation. We left, and the labels wanted to leave with us. And then later on, Torgny ended up leaving, and he came in. He became managing director of the company. And then later, Jonas, when he bought out the German company, Edel, he bought it out, then he came into the company, but he wasn't a part of the company in the beginning. So it was just those of us who weren't happy with the situation left and then started Playground. And Torgny wasn't a part of it in the early stage. We were up and running. He finally said, no, I've had enough, and then he left.
And so you became head of international there, I guess?
Yeah, my position just moved, you know. I didn't change anything. I mean, I've always been a part of A&R and things like that and pitching things, and then later was involved in publishing. And then the last, I would say, last 8 years, maybe even 10 years, Sync has been coming to grow. And then I became the head of Sync licensing. Finally, they decided they wanted to renew a lot of A&R there. And which is good. That's the way to think, you know, thinking forward, thinking about the future. And we're not getting any younger, so bringing in new blood, new people. And they decided that for publishing too, they would find a new person to handle that. They've done that, and now I'm being involved in helping her into the catalog and those things. And she's really great. She comes from a good publishing background, and she's amazing. So I'm very happy that she's in the company, actually.
Nice. So I guess it started in like 99, and then, so the head of international, it's mainly exploiting masters internationally.
Yeah, at that time it was about licensing, you know, getting labels to pick up the master, license it, manufacture, and do promotion and work it in the territory. And we were very successful in getting things done at that time. And then when the Pirate Bay and all of that hit and streaming started to come about and Napster and all of them, the business started to change, and really rapidly. And people were no longer licensing. And therefore it became a thing, okay, what do you do? Okay, let's do this and let's do this. And I started working with Sync, and I started working with other publishing. and building up our publishing catalog from the early days, and, you know, signing a couple writers and artists. I signed Knife Girl from Finland, who's now starting to grow. She's playing big venues and really starting to become huge. Early on, working with Smith and Tell, and also Jesper Wallander, who's written many songs for Mellow Festival, all of Ken Ring's biggest hits. You know, so those are things that, you know, I did, but it felt like it's, you know, time to change the guard, let new people come in. And I got so involved in Sync, I was doing more business there, and also infringements, you know, hunting people who used our rights illegally and trying to make it legal or make them pay.
And from what I understand, you also became head of, you became a label manager for Network Records in 2015?
Yes, I was head of Network. I also was doing K7, Naive, Ninja Tune, Sugar Hill, Rounder, maybe a couple, Munich, that's out of Holland. There was quite a few labels, mostly roots, world music, electronic music, some hip hop through K7, you know, like, I'm trying to remember the name of it, but the labels, but they were very underground type of hip hop. And it was all this left of center stuff that I personally get into. And then country, singer, songwriter, world music, like World Circuit, you know, Buena Vista Social Club, and a lot of these labels I was working with. And then Rounder got bought by Universal because they wanted the next Alison Krauss and Robert Plant album. I mean, we broke Alison Krauss here. You understand? We broke her here. We broke a mandolin player who was named, now her name escapes me too, Rhonda Vincent. And we broke her record. She would sell like 3,000, 4,000 records in Sweden at that time. Now, when they got bought up by Universal, you know, they don't sell anything now. Maybe stream some to the fans, but, you know, that day just ended. And then Sugar Hill got bought. I'm not sure who bought them. It was a major as well. Then World Circuit, a couple years later, got bought. And then K7 decided to do all their distribution themselves from Germany. And Munich, they also, you know, they ended up leaving for another label. You know, it was at a time when, you know, digital and everything, a lot of turbulence. So people were searching for ways to do things. And a lot of labels, you know, ended up laying down. But those labels I worked with, and I mean, I worked with great artists like M83, Alison Krauss, you know, Rhonda Vincent. At Munich, there was like, you know, John Prine's catalog and all sorts of stuff.
What was the role there at Network? You were the one signing or the label
manager? I was the label manager, product manager. So I worked with Jenny Owen Youngs. She toured here. She was on MTV. She's amazing. Ladytron at that time was on Network. I was working that. It was a lot of different, Mauve, a lot of different things. Skinny Puppy was released there. A lot of really cool kind of left of center electronic stuff. And then, you know, they did have some pop and rock that we worked with. Farabee, Lionheart, and things like that. He toured quite often, recorded with a local artist. And yeah, it was a very cool time.
Did your licensing job, did you see it become easier or in any way positively affected by the certain Swedish names that were bringing attention in the 90s or the 2000s, like Dennis Pop and the Cheiron guys?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, when Sweden became like a brand music in the music industry, you know, we were getting requests for stuff all over the world for licensing at that time. And then it would have been pre-2000. But, you know, then when everything started to implode because of the illegal Pirate Bay and all that stuff, it just kind of took it all away. And there was no more licensing because people were afraid that, you know, and they were doing all this silly stuff to protect masters and, you know, with the, oh, I can't remember what they call it when they code everything and on CDs and stuff like that. And it just felt like, you know, yeah, well, you're not going to stop them, but we fought anyway. You fought for legislation. You tried to do it legally.
You talked about sometimes having to go after people from infringement. Can you share any story about a particular case?
Yeah, I'll share a story, but I won't mention any artist's name or something. But we have this big artist. He's a dance artist. He's big, actually, all over the world, and we're talking millions of streams. And some kid in the U.S., and at the beginning, I couldn't find him. He'd released this song. It was one of our big singles, streamed like in the millions. Released this dance song as his name, his artist name, and that he wrote it in the credits, everything. Same exact song as ours. It's easy because all our stuff is digitally fingerprinted, so we find it. All of that, you know, people think they can hide behind digital and not putting their name out there and stuff. We can find it. We can even call a distributor. And even if they're indemnified, ideally a distributor, a digital distributor who releases something illegally through another label, they're indemnified because they don't know that's illegal. But when they take the money that they earn, they become complicit. Then they're in trouble. It's just like buying a stolen car. If you sell a stolen car, whether you know it's stolen or not, you're still complicit in the act of selling that stolen car. So this guy releases this song, steals the name, steals the identity. That's fraud. So I started searching for him, and he wasn't easy to find. But I searched sites. I kept looking for him. And finally, I find a picture where he's standing in front of a high school alma mater logo with the name of the high school. So I called the high school. I said, I really like this guy's music. We're interested in his music, but I need to get a hold of him. How do I do it? You know, I don't know him, but he goes to the school, and I got his email, whereby I told him I was going to have him arrested for fraud because I found his address. I found his email, and I just laid it out. I said, you have committed fraud. You've taken on the identity of our artist. You've said you've wrote this. You've committed theft, and we're going to sue you for 10,000 euros or whatever I said, but lots of money, and we're going to have you arrested. And then, of course, he sent me a mail, said, I didn't know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, this is 2023, mate. Everybody knows about copyright law, so don't play that game with me. You are going to pay me money for this infringement. You are going to go to jail, and I want you to know that up front now. You have 2 days to get back to me and sort this. Otherwise, the police will be picking you up. 2 days later, I get a call from a lawyer. And the lawyer tells me, you're doing absolutely the right thing, which was really weird. His pitch was excellent. I gave him credit for his pitch because he said, you're absolutely right. He's fraudulent. He should be punished by the highest thing of the law. You know, he has broken this and this and this. You're absolutely right. Everything you say is right. And he goes, now I'm going to take my lawyer hat off and I'm going to put my dad hat on. And he goes, now I'm a dad. Are you a dad? And I go, yeah, I'm a dad. He goes, how many kids you got? I go, 7. He goes, your kids have fucked up on occasion, haven't they? They've really been stupid on occasion. Every kid is stupid at some point. So I said, yes, that's correct. And he goes, well, this kid, he's a fucking idiot. This is so stupid, I can't even believe it myself. He said, but he's a good kid. He said, this would destroy him. And he said, if he was an evil kid and I didn't like him, I would fucking say, yeah, let's do this. But he's not. He's a good kid. He's just stupid. He did something stupid. He didn't think it through. And he did this. And I said, okay, that was a good pitch. I appreciate that pitch. That was an excellent pitch. And I'm going to buy into it. I said, this is what we can do. I go, he's got to pay some money. He can't get away scot-free. I go, I'll drop the idea of calling the police. I'll drop that. But he's got to pay this much money within this period of time and buy a book. And not only buy the book, I want a picture of him with the book. And not only that, I want you to, as a lawyer, ensure me, promise me he's going to read this book, which is Donald S. Passman's book, All You Need to Know About the Music Business, edition 11. So this kid, within a month's time, he paid the money, everything I requested. He bought the book. They took a picture. I also promised that once I saw the picture with the book, I'd tear it up and throw it away. So we got the picture with the book, tore it up, case closed. We signed off on this, got paid, case closed. But I told him, if that kid does it again, I'm going to go after him hard. But I think he learned his lesson.
Given how much stuff that you've done in Sweden the last 30, 40 years, do you think you would have had such a long-running career with large indie labels like M&W and Playground had you stayed in the U.S.?
That's a real good question. I like to think that I could migrate to cool labels and work with them, but it's, I don't know. I just thought that I fit in really well here. I mean, I knew from the summer when I landed in Sweden, I even said, you know, to myself, I said, here, this is where all my dreams, all my ambitions, everything are going to happen here. And I got lucky as well. You know, I met the right people at the right time. Doors opened. I stepped in and I moved on and I just kept growing in the industry. It's been a fantastic ride. And I thank Mikkel von Hauswolf, Ulrich Hillebrand at Radium, Eric Pauser also there. I thank them for that opportunity to do that practique. I thank Jonas Kerstrom, who's also the godfather of my daughter, Angelica. You know, thank him for giving me a life here. It's because of him. He always jokes and say, you know, you would have figured it out somehow. And maybe, but still, he gave me an opportunity. He gave me a life and a career here. And it's grown. I'm still involved with Playground. And even with me having now my own label on the side, I'm still, you know, 50% Playground. And I love it. I love it.
No, that's great. Tell me about this label. You have Bark at Your Owner now and Howling Jazz and...
And Pow in the Face. It came about during the pandemic. My partner, business partner, Carl Marcus Yedlove, who also has, he's co-owner of Despots and he's owner of Icons Creating Evil Art. He and I took walks during the pandemic. You know, we'd put on the mask and we'd go and take walks. And we started talking about opportunity to work together in some way. And I felt that at Playground that, you know, they were aiming at, like I said, renewing, looking at new things. And I loved working with publishing, but they wanted to renew and find new creative people, which I support. That's, you know, Jonas owns it. It's his decision, and I respect that, and I follow that real rule completely. But I still felt that I had, you know, I had some creative juice left in me and really wanted to do something creative. And through this discussions and these walks I had with Carl, we were able to come up with an idea, which I pitched to Jonas, and I wanted to talk with Jonas because he's a person I respect. And because of the fact that he gave me a life here, I didn't want to just like up and just move. I said, I got an idea and I wanted you to hear me out. And I pitched it to him and Morten Aglander, who's the MD there. And I said, you know, what do you think of this idea? And so we decided that we would do that. And they gave me some rope to do that, but I could also continue to work sync licensing and infringements. And so it's kind of the best of both worlds. I mean, Bark at Your Owner. Well, my whole philosophy with the label, I wanted to have a lot of fuck you in the attitude, in the label and the music. You know, I don't want to be told that we can't do that or we can't do this. And I don't want to tell an artist that either. I want them to say, yeah, I want to do this and want to do that. Yeah, do that. Great. Do that. You know, make it great. And I also wanted to have a better balance. I wanted to have, you know, 70% women, transgender, non-binary, LGBTQ+ artist. And it doesn't mean I'm segregating dudes or guys. I wanted to find just good talent, but I wanted to percentually seek more women, LGBTQ+, and non-binary, transgender, which I've done. I'm over 70%. I have, you know, I have some guys like Colin and the Clouds, which are a synth pop duo, two guys from Uppsala, Daniel Carlson Trio, you know, they're guys, Cougar from Iceland, he's a guy. So Bark at Your Owner is all for the left of center, alternative, indie, you know, it could be a bedroom pop to alternative dark wave to goth. I just don't do metal or hip hop because there's so many others that do it better than me. So I just feel, I mean, it can be influenced by that, but I mean, actual labels that do hip hop do it better than me, and metal labels, we have Despots and they do it great. So why should I try to compete with them? And then Howling Jazz, of course, is for jazz. And I have now 6 artists on my jazz label. Daniel Carlson, I got Liliana Savala, who was nominated for a Grammy this year for Best Folk World Music. You know, I got Vidya, she's Indian, Swedish, jazz. I got Nina Grigorieva, who's doing folk and jazz. So it's like, you know, and then Atacama Sound System, which is world music, electronica, you know, Latin jazz, you know. So Natalie Knutson, who's also Latin jazz. So it's like a good stall of artists to work with. And then Pow in the Face was more for like catalog items, also pop, oddball pop songs or EPs. You know, just somebody I think is cool or like, and I just want to work with them. But it's a pop thing. Or like guitar pop, like the Nowness from Uppsala. Just because, you know, it's, I just, you know, kind of dig that Nick Lowe, Elvis Costello kind of pop rock. But it doesn't fit on my other two labels, so.
All right. This has been a nice conversation.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming. We covered the short version of your career. Maybe we can do a part two sometime.
Yeah, sure.
Anything you want to end off with? In conclusion, what have you got going on for the rest of this year? Like, what's your major focus?
My major focus right now is Daniel Carlson Trio, album out, LP, CD, digital. He's touring. He's got like 40 dates. So, you know, pre-promoting, like sending, you know, press releases and stuff to the venues and the local media and radios to kind of get them to come out and see him live. For reviews, also if they want to do interviews, that I do. And then preparing Pokaz Trio. That's my first Ukraine signing. And I went to Jazz Ahead just to sign a Ukraine jazz band because I wanted to support something in the arts there instead of killing that we promote creativeness. And, you know, it's been some weird stuff that's gone on during this process, but the album's ready and it's going to be released in 1st of February with a couple singles before, one this fall. And then an Australian artist called Aluna Wolf, very like, you know, if you think back in the day, men used to be like exploitative. She's exploitative of her own sexuality in this. And I think it's very provocative. And she's very much an artist who sticks by her guns. So even when I kind of got cowardly and said, well, maybe we should, and I just go, okay. You know, so the video will definitely raise some eyebrows. But she's kind of important coming up. And then albums with the Nowness, album with Halloween album coming Friday the 13th. So it's a lot. It's fun, but it keeps me hopping.
No, clearly you stay busy. We'll keep an eye out for all those things.
Yes, thank you.
And thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. It's been really fun.
Awesome.